Welcome to the Mosaic Mind. I'm Krishnan Iyer. Exploring stories of growth, culture, and durable happiness. Part 1, Chai Roots. Today, I want to take you on a journey. Not across continents, but across cups. This is the story of how I moved from chai, wine, and whiskey to tea, and how that shift gave me back ritual, flavor, and joy while aligning with health and longevity. My love of chai began in Mumbai. Even though I grew up in a South Indian household where coffee was religion, South Indian filter coffee wasn't just a drink in my family. It was sacred. Every week, my parents sent me to the India Coffee Board shop in Sion, a metro station in the central side of Mumbai train system in the 80s to buy chicory and peaberry coffee. I'd carried a packet home, and the next morning, my mom would roast it in the kitchen. The whole house would fill with the rich smell of coffee. But maybe because coffee was so central to my family, I resisted. The Mumbai in me, the teenager who didn't want to be exactly like his parents, found his way to chai. With my friends in college, we'd sit at Guru Krupa in Sion, a famous little spot where samosas and chai came together after class. That's where my tea journey truly began. We'd sip sweet milky chais and talk about everything college kids talk about. Juniors, seniors, plans, dreams. I also love the chais. I tasted in Maharashtrian households. Always sweet, always comforting. Of course, those days, chai had plenty of sugar. But for me, it wasn't just about sweetness. It was about independence. Chai was my drink, not my parents. Part 2, The Wine Chapter. In my family, alcohol was never considered something good. My dad had seen his friends destroy their lives with it, and he swore an oath never to drink or smoke. Ironically, though, he was the first person in Mumbai to manufacture ether, a form of alcohol, in a chemical plant. He spent years incubating and iterating until it became the first anesthesia delivered to hospitals in the city. So growing up, alcohol was completely off the table. I never touched it. But fate had other plans. In the 1990s, I found myself in Italy, and there, wine was everywhere. People drank it the way we drank coffee or tea. It carried no stigma, no negativity. It was part of life, part of meals, part of culture. That's where my journey began. Andrea, a friend from Florence, first opened the door for me into the world of wine. He poured his family's homemade vintage, crafted by his father with knowledge passed down through generations. We drank it together, and nothing bad happened. On the contrary, it felt rich. It felt alive. That was my first true encounter with wine. Later came Luigi, who welcomed me into his farmhouse in Endine and shared his grandfather's treasured recipe for Nocino, along with the Finnish spirit itself. From there, my palate grew. I fell in love with wines from northern Italy, especially in Friuli. There was this one, Fragolino Bianco, a white wine that tasted like wild strawberries, unique to that region. It wasn't available anywhere else. That exclusivity, that sense of terroir, fascinated me. But I always leaned red, starting from the King of Wines, Barolo, and other Italian classics like Brunello di Montalcino, Chianti Classico, Amarone, Montepulciano, and even the Sicilian Reds, Nerello Mascales, Nerello Cappuccio, and Etna Rosso. Later, I found myself exploring bold Californian Reds, Napa, Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, Sonoma, Coast Pinot Noir, and Santa Barbara Pinot Noir. Living in Washington, it was natural to discover the depth of Eastern Washington wines, Walla Walla Syrah, Red Mountain Cabernet, Columbia Valley Merlot, and Horse Heaven Hills blends. Spanish Tempranillo also found its way into my glass with its earthy depth and elegance. Even some of the bold Australian Reds that made their way into Trader Joe's had their moment. White wines like Rieslings or Gewürztraminers never really stuck with me, though I remember enjoying them at Chateau Saint-Michel in Woodinville with spicy Indian food. Still, I always returned to my Reds. Wine became more than a drink. It became a journey. With my son and daughter, I visited vineyards across Italy. Month-long trips through Friuli, Verona, Sicily. Friends like Claudio and Giulia Bosinello deepened that connection, introducing us to regional traditions. In Sicily, Giovanni's brother-in-law introduced me to Nerello Cappuccio, one of Mount Etna's indigenous grapes, often blended into Etna Rosso, adding volcanic richness and identity to the wine. Each bottle was a story of place and people. And then there was whiskey. For the Indian diaspora, whiskey carried its own cultural weight. In India, especially in the 80s and 90s, alcohol was tightly regulated, much like America during Prohibition. You could only buy whiskey in certain government stores. And that scarcity gave it prestige. Drinking whiskey became a symbol of wealth, success, even sophistication. But I always leaned whiskey. From the first sip of an Islay single malt, I was hooked by the smoky peat, sea spray, and raw character of whiskies, like Laphroaig, Lagavulin, and Ardbeg. Over time, I explored the rest of Islay, the elegance of Bowmore, the balance of Caol Ila, the restrained smoke of Bunahabain, and the quiet depth of Bruich Ladich. Of course, there was also the world of blends, Johnny Walker, Chivas Regal, Ballantines. The bottles that defined celebrations and family gatherings for so many in the Indian diaspora, where whiskey became more than a drink. It became a ritual of connection. Occasionally, I'd stray toward the Highlands for a Glenmorangie, the Speyside richness of Macallan or Glenfiddich, or even across the world to the harmony of Japanese Hibiki and Yamazaki, or the bold spice of an American bourbon. But the truth is, I always came back to the island, to that windswept coastline and the unmistakable peat smoke of Islay. So for nearly three decades, wine and whiskey gave me richness, ritual, culture. Each glass was more than a drink. It was history, geography, craftsmanship. It was connection. But beneath it all, a question was always waiting for me. Could I keep the ritual without the risk? Part 3. Longevity wake-up call. For years, wine and whiskey gave me ritual and joy. But I began to ask myself a deeper question. Was this really aligned with the life I wanted to live? That's when I started listening to voices like Peter Attia, Andrew Huberman, and Rhonda Patrick, who all highlight how even moderate alcohol damages the brain. It's not just about liver health. Alcohol destroys neurons and weakens the brain's critical connections as we age. In the Huberman Lab episode, Andrew explains how alcohol acts as a poison, causing neurodegeneration, inflammation, thinning of gray matter, and impaired neuronal function, even in moderate amounts. Peter Tia has also unpacked how alcohol degrades sleep, disrupts insulin sensitivity, and adds cardiovascular and cognitive risk. Rhonda Patrick, in her deep dive discussion, is blunt. Even small amounts of alcohol increase cancer risk, disrupt gut health, and for longevity, zero is better than any. When I heard them, something clicked. I was trying to strengthen my brain, not add to its natural decline. But I loved the culture, the nuance, the community wine brought. So I thought, what now? And then I came across Eric Topol's new book, Super Agers, an evidence-based approach to longevity. In it, Topol highlights how we're living longer and healthier by nurturing lifestyle habits, not chasing quick fixes. He emphasizes strength training, diet, sleep, social connection, and yes, eliminating alcohol as keys to preserving our health span. That realization was transformative. I loved ritual. Now I wanted it to align with longevity. Part 4. Tea as the new wine. So I asked myself, if not wine or whiskey, then what? I still craved ritual. I still wanted depth, community, and culture. I didn't want to give up the joy of savoring a drink with friends. That's when tea revealed itself as the perfect replacement. I still remember the late 1990s when I was transiting through Narita International Airport in Tokyo. I had an overnight layover, and in the morning, I asked for tea. What they gave me was a small white cup with a yellowish liquid, genmaicha. I drank it and thought, what? Where's my chai tea? Back then, chai wasn't global like it is today, and I couldn't understand why anyone would drink this plain rice-infused green tea. And yet, 30 years later, I find myself savoring the same cup, smiling at how life has a way of changing our taste. Then came matcha. I've always loved fresh green flavors, like how Comté cheese feels earthy and alive. Matcha gave me that same fresh vitality, powdered into a ritual, whisking, frothing, focusing. It became meditative and energizing at once. In Seattle, my curiosity grew. I went to the Seattle Tea Festival, where rows of vendors poured samples of delicate green teas, roasted oolongs, and aged pu'ers, each stall buzzing with conversations about water temperature, clay pots, and steeping times. I wandered through Chinatown's tea shops, smelling leaves from glass jars, and learning how much history was packed into a single cup. Even in the sauna at my local gym, the tea talk continued. One gentleman leaned over and told me about Dahong Pao, the legendary Chinese oolong, so rare that in the 1960s, a small pouch of it was presented as a gift to President John F. Kennedy. Today, you can still find Dahong Pao in Chinese stores, but almost all are imitations. Still, that story shifted something for me. It wasn't just about taste anymore. It was about respect, rarity, and the long thread of history that connects each leaf to something larger. The same Chinese friend, David, introduced me to Chen Pei, tea aged with dried tangerine peel. It softened the sharpness of black tea, adding roundness and depth. I discovered that Chen Pei could be 1 year, 5 years, even 20 years old, with prices climbing as high as fine wines. Again, the parallels between tea and vintages were impossible to miss. From there, I explored jasmine teas, Chinese green teas, and moved away from tea bags into the world of loose leaf brewing. Amazon Prime Day even equipped me with stainless steel filters that I carried everywhere. All I needed was hot water and my flask. And suddenly, tea was with me wherever I traveled, even back to Italy, where wine once dominated my days. Tea didn't just replace wine, it expanded my world. It gave me ritual, community, culture, and even practical benefits. When I began experimenting with fasting, tea became my companion, calming hunger, giving energy, and making the practice sustainable. Tea became my new wine. It gave me everything I loved in wine and whiskey, nuance, culture, even aging. But instead of taking years away, it aligned me with the longevity. Part 5, The Craft of Brewing. The first time I had what many people would call a poor tea, I actually loved it. It was earthy, a little rough, almost muddy. For me, it had character, though I know plenty of people would have spit it out. Like most people, I started out brewing tea the easy way. Tea bags, 10 or 15 little sachets in a cardboard box dunked into hot water. Sometimes milk and sugar, because that's how chai was made at home. Later, I learned that those bags weren't always the best. Not just for flavor, but for health. That's when I began exploring loose leaf. At first, I experimented with whatever equipment I had. I even tried a French press for a while, starting with a big one, then, later, a smaller IKEA version, maybe 12 or 16 ounces. It worked, but it wasn't quite right. More recently, I used those double-walled glass bottles with built-in filters. They were convenient. I could carry tea everywhere. But the problem was that the leaves were steeping continuously as I sipped. So by the end, the tea tasted bitter and over-extracted. That's when I discovered the Gaiwan, a small Chinese brewing cup, usually around 120 milliliters. With the Gaiwan, you brew in short, precise infusions. You control the water temperature, you control the steep time, you pour it out completely. The flavor transforms. Delicate, layered, alive. And then there was Alice at Red Blossom Tea in San Francisco's Chinatown. I wandered into several shops, but hers stood out immediately. She not only sourced teas directly from artisanal farmers, she also taught me how to honor them. Hot brews, cold brews, the importance of timing, and above all, respect for the leaf. But the biggest breakthrough came when I noticed the kettle Alice was using, the Fellow Stag EKG Pro, a sleek, precision, electric gooseneck kettle. Until then, I had tried all kinds of basic American kettles. Nothing special, but this was different. With its walnut wood handle and precise temperature control, it turned brewing from guesswork into science and art. Once I got my own, everything changed. The consistency, the control, the confidence. It elevated my tea practice overnight. My explorations didn't stop there. On trips to Vancouver's downtown Chinatown, I discovered the Ten Ren Tea Flagship Store, their version of a Starbucks for tea. There, I tried beautiful Chinese and Taiwanese teas and learned how people from each culture treat them differently, depending on their heritage and traditions. That opened another window into tea's cultural identity. At the same time, I began blending in some of my own roots. From South India, I explored ginseng tea, the cooling root vetiver, and nanari, a traditional herb used to make summer brews. I experimented with brewing them into teas of my own. And because I also love gardening, I grew calendula flowers in my hydroponic garden, dried out the petals, and brewed them into tea as well. These became exciting little passion projects, moments where my love of tea, plants, and experimentation all came together in one cup. Since then, my brewing journey has been about exploration and refinement. I've experimented with teas like Dragon Well, Longjing, Flat, Green, Toasty, Refreshing, Bi Luo Chun, Delicate Floral Spirals, Da Hong Pao, Big Red Robe, Legendary Wuyi Oolong, Rich and Roasted, Golden Monkey, Jin Shu Hong Cha, Sweet Malty Black Tea, Japanese Teas, Genmaicha, Matcha, Sencha, Hojicha, Chinese Classics, Jasmine Green, Mo Li Hua Cha, Dong Ding, Tung Ting, Alishan, and other high mountain oolongs, even Goji Berry Tea at a Nanking restaurant in San Francisco's Chinatown. Each tea taught me something different. Patience, attention, humility, and each brewing method, from bags to presses, to Gaiwan, to the stag kettle, from Ten Ren's tasting tables to my own hydroponic calendula petals, reminded me that tea isn't just about taste. It's about practice, creativity, and connection. Once I started paying attention to temperature, timing, and method, the cup changed. Bitterness gave way to balance. Flatness opened into depth. Tea was no longer a routine. It became a relationship between me, the leaves, and the moment. Part 6. Tea, health, and connection. Tea has also become a tool for connection, and the reason this podcast exists. Friends and family kept asking, "How did you get into tea? What do you drink?" Those questions made me want to share the journey more openly as an invitation, not just a story. It also fits my intermittent fasting practice. In the mornings, green tea became my companion. No calories, steady focus, and a ritual that made fasting feel easier and more intentional. So here's my invitation. Let's connect. What did you think about this episode? Did any part resonate or not? Send me a message or email and share your story. And if you'd like, I'm happy to do a separate episode on my intermittent fasting journey. What worked, what didn't, and how tea fit into it. If that sounds useful, tell me. I'm grateful to live at a time and place where I can transform my love of culture, nuance, taste, and ceremony into a healthier ritual. I haven't sworn off wine. I'll still enjoy a few glasses once in a while, maybe once a month with my wife, instead of half a bottle every weekend like before. But today, tea is my daily practice. It helps me stay healthy, stay connected, and keep the culture I love. Brew a cup, share it with someone, and see what happens. Thanks for listening, and I can't wait to hear your stories.